Amazing. Yeah, so for those of you who don't know me, my name's Adam. I've actually got a cool bit of history with this building. It's quite cool to be here again, but where's Stuart McCrill? I saw you here earlier. There he is. Stuart believes in miracles because Stuart has seen one and he's standing here. No, but that man was here when I came into this building about 17 years ago. Rough. I was a problem child. I really, really was. And who said amen? Is that my wife? My wife, Ellie. She found me after the Lord had his way with me a bit, which I'm very grateful for. But yeah, man, I actually really, like, I came back to the Lord in this building. I quit smoking in that car park about 16 years ago. Got baptized in the pool that they had just out here. And it's really, like, it is amazing for me to actually be here again. And the reason I'm amazed and the reason I'm so grateful is because all of this happens through the gospel. And even the reason I'm here tonight, so I'm part of the Milnerton congregation now. We've been on their eldership team for a while. And we were silly enough to put up our hands when someone said, "Hey, who feels like maybe they want to plant a church?" And I was like, "That sounds like a great idea." And I put up my hand for it. And we've been on this incredible church planting course of just being equipped and upskilled. And it really has been incredible. There's been a lot of time and training and input and prophetic words and strategy and all this stuff. But can I tell you, man, the one thing that all of this has done in me is make me alive again to the gospel. I am more convinced than ever that the thing this world needs is the gospel, that the only thing this world needs is the gospel, that the gospel is enough to save you, to heal you, that the sick and broken and dying planet needs the gospel. And all of these things we do, churches and 412 and courses and poiky competitions and men's camps and all of these things are aimed at getting the gospel out. That is why we are here. If you're wondering what your purpose is as a follower of Jesus, it is that. It is to carry the gospel. But right at the start of this thing, I don't know who said it to him, but Dan said it to me, so I'm going to credit him with it. But it is that the gospel comes to us to go through us. And if you want to be a carrier of the gospel, you have to have had that gospel come into you. You have to know what this thing is and eat it and understand it and have it define you. Because when it comes into us, then it is able to go through us. We're able to carry this thing that we have. And so I'm convinced that the gospel is what we need and that the church, if nothing else, is how this gospel goes out. So it's how this gospel is sent, but it's also how this gospel is worked out. Because I came to this church 17 years ago and I had an incredible response to the gospel. And if the story had just ended there, I would probably still be smoking in the car park outside. But it's because that gospel was walked out in me in the church that I've changed and transformed into this new thing. And so today I'm going to preach the gospel to this church. And that might seem like a weird thing to do because most of you are probably here because you already know Jesus and you already love him. So why preach the gospel? Well, part of it is curiosity. Maybe everyone's going to respond and that'll raise some really interesting questions about Jacques' leadership. No, but really, I'm actually wanting to do in you what has been done in me, which is that this gospel, man, it is the treasure. And even on a night like tonight, I'm so encouraged because I know the Lord loves me because I can read it in the Bible and everybody tells me and it sounds right. But man, there are moments like tonight where I know the Lord loves me because I can see it. I can see how he sets up and orchestrates a meeting actually for what he's put on my heart to share. And it's in a way just a measure of his kindness to me. But even in worship, man, we started singing about this holy, holy God. And it is beautiful and it is awe-inspiring and it sets off something in me. But there's also this thing of like, "God, you're so holy, but I'm so not." And then we start singing about the gospel and how the gospel is the thing that actually makes us able to stand here and worship this beautiful, holy, perfect God. And then we move into how this God starts to actually speak to us and minister to each one of us. But that word holy, that holiness that we're singing about, it actually does present quite a big problem for you and I. Because holiness, it's a difficult word to define because it is a word that speaks to the very nature of God himself. If you want to know the definition of holiness, the definition is God. And what it means is set apart, unlike anything else. There's nothing else like him. There will never be anything else like him. There's nothing that comes close. He is fully divine. He's utterly unique. He's totally set apart. There's nothing in all of creation like God. He is perfect in every way, fully complete. And this God, he creates everything. So everything you see, all of creation that is ever made, is made by and through God. We're created by him. We're created in his image. We're created for him. We're created to take our identity and our thoughts and the way we think and our emotions and the way we act, the way we define ourselves, our nature, our very character is to be taken from the person of God because he made us in his image. And he looks at this creation he has made and he says, this thing that I have done, it is good. And God's plan, the whole reason, the whole purpose of him doing this all was so that he would be our God and we would be his people. That is it. That is the sum total of the reason for your existence, is that it just gave God good pleasure to make you. But he made you for himself. But the problem is, and we know the story if you've read Genesis, even if you only made it that far in your Bible, well done. But we see that right in the beginning in Genesis, sin enters into the world and it messes up actually the natural order of things. Satan comes and he deceives Eve and he says, listen, no longer will you take your identity and find your fulfillment and find your meaning and your purpose and the way you think and everything about you. No longer will your character even be defined by God. You're going to choose now. You're going to decide. And that's why the Lord hates idolatry so much. Behind the sin, behind every sin, actually lies the sin of idolatry. It is when we take the creature, what's been made, and we place it above the person of God. And so sin comes in and it corrupts us and it messes us up. And no longer do we draw our identity from the Lord, but we become shaped by this terrible thing that has entered into us. And it infects us. It infects all of us. When we talk about sinners, we're not being super judgmental. It is your native state. It's a statement of fact. You and me, we're born sinners. We're born corrupted. We're born messed up. And that creates this incredible problem for us when we start singing about a holy God. And I was trying to think of a way to describe this, because why, if God is holy, and why, if he is so kind, and why, if he is so perfect, can he not just overlook this thing that is in us? And a great example of this is actually the sun, S-U-N. I know you're being very spiritual and thinking S-O-N, but the sun. You know, the sun is this utterly unique thing in our solar system. It is the source of warmth, of light, of life. It sustains us. It warms us. It's beautiful. It makes plants grow. It dictates weather patterns. It's this beautiful thing in our creation that we can look to and we can see every day. But the very thing that makes it so powerful and so good is also the thing that makes it so dangerous for us. Get too close to that thing and see what happens. Even those like me of European descent, we only have to walk around it for a little while. And we start going pink and losing skin. But the very thing that makes this thing so beautiful and perfect is the very thing that will annihilate us if we actually get close to it. And that is the problem of holiness and our brokenness. And this is the great paradox, actually, of God, is that our nature, our state, our sinfulness, our brokenness, it actually makes him dangerous to us if we get too close. But this God made us for himself. And so there's this problem that desperately needs to be overcome. And so the problem is that he can't change. God cannot in himself become less holy. He is what he is. But also, he doesn't want us to be destroyed. And he wants us close. And so something somewhere has got to give. Something has got to change. And that thing that has to change is us. It's our nature. It's the thing that's inside of us. It is our sin and our brokenness. And we see this so much in the Old Testament. You know, Moses in the burning bush. He comes into the presence of God. And God says, Moses, actually, just because I am here, the very ground you're standing on is holy. You can't come closer. You have to take off your shoes. You have to treat this differently because I'm here. If you come too close, you'll die. We see this in the moral purity laws, you know. Sin has entered, the relationship's messed up. We can't be in God's presence, yet somehow he still loves us and he longs for us. And so he makes this way that we can kind of be close to him, and he brings out these laws. So that's why we have these laws, is that sin demands punishment. It's the natural order of things. And so we have these moral purity laws. If you sin, you have to repent. If you kill a man, you know, there's an eye for an eye. If you steal a man's thing, you have to go and make recompense. There's all these moral laws that dictate how we can make right when we transgress against one another and against God. But also there are all these ritual laws. And this is, you know, not necessarily just sin, but because this planet is corrupted, because it's broken, the very impurity of it bleeds through into us. And so now we become ritually unclean and impure just because we're living on broken planet Earth. And that makes us unable to come into God's presence, because things like sickness and death and disease and all these things were not the natural order. They weren't actually part of God's design and creation. They came in and through brokenness. And so when these things touch us, they infect us, they change us, and now suddenly we can't come into God's presence. Now, you know, I love surfing, and a few years ago, I was on a surf trip up the West Coast with some mates, and we're walking along the beach, and we're being a bit silly because we're boys, and we're camping, and we didn't have wives, and we're irresponsible. And as we're walking along the beach, there's all these little sort of humps on the beach, and we're running and kind of jumping on them, just being playful kids. And I see this little hump, and I run, and I jump onto it. What I didn't know is that that hump was, someone had found a dead seal, and they had buried this thing in the sand. And I didn't know it, and it had been there for a while. And so I jumped onto this thing and basically went knee-deep into hot, dead, liquid seal. And I'll tell you what, man, my foot touched that thing, and I knew that something here was not okay. And it was a second. My foot was in, and I was out of that thing. I levitated. But I'll tell you what, man, that smell, that thing that attached to me just from a second of contact with this, I could not get it out. I couldn't get it out of my wetsuit. I couldn't get it out of my booties. Everyone around me could smell it. I had a week that I was still surfing with these guys, and they were like, "Brew, you are camping there. And don't bring that wetsuit next to us." And I tried everything. I washed it. I tried to bleach it. Nothing I did could remove that stench from me. And that's kind of what sin does. It's what brokenness does. And you know, the funny thing is that even that seal, that was something that happened as an accident. But man, the stuff I have chosen to do, the choices I have deliberately made against God and against his ways, and the sin of that that attaches not to the outside of me where it can be washed off, but inside. That is the problem of our impurity when it comes to his purity. And we know this. If you touch something that stinks, you're going to stink. Unfortunately, it doesn't work the other way. It's not like, "Hey, man, I used my Old Spice this morning and the seal is going to smell better." It's like, no, I smell like it. And that's the problem with impurity. And so even then, God, he can't overlook the sin. He can't overlook the impurity because he just can't. He's holy. He's perfect. And so even there, that's why there was these systems of sacrifices. Something had to be done to pay for the penalty and the price of the sin. And so, you know, God loved us enough that he didn't actually want us to die. So he said, "Man, I can't overlook what you've done. The next best thing I can do is take what you've done and put it on something else and let that thing die, so that you and I can be restored, so that you and I can be intimate again." Even in the Old Testament, we see there's this temple in the Holy of Holies. There's this place that houses the presence of God, and it's this kind of hotspot of where the Lord is. And even that thing, there's only one man, one time a year, after a lot of purification, who can go in there. And even there, he's not in there really to commune with the Lord. He's there to make atonement. That is not the relationship that God wanted for us. It's not how he wanted to relate to us. And so there's this plan that starts to formulate and unfold that we see through the Old Testament. And it's really this beautiful story, because all these Old Testament laws and these Old Testament ways, they were at best kind of an accommodation, a way to sort of deal with sin and sort of bring you close and sort of you're my people. But there's this distance and this separation, and God is looking at this and saying, man, this is not the plan. This is not what it was supposed to be like. This is not what I wanted for your lives. It was a garden and you and me walking in the cool of the day and hanging out and chatting and shooting the breeze. And so there was proximity between God and his people, but there wasn't intimacy. And it is the intimacy that he wanted. And so, you know, God is basically, he reaches this point where he's like, I'm done working through intermediaries and priests and prophets and judges. I want my people. I want them back. And so he calls this man, Isaiah. I love this picture. Maybe you can put up Isaiah 6, verse 1 to 6. But it says, in the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord seated on a throne, high and exalted, and the train of his robe filled the temple. Above him were seraphs, each with six wings. And two wings they covered their faces, and with two they covered their feet, and with two they were flying. And they were calling to one another, holy, holy, holy is the Lord Almighty. The whole earth is filled with his glory. And at the sound of their voices, the doorpost and the threshold shook, and the temple was filled with smoke. And I love this. I think this is the most appropriate response. Woe to me, I cried. I am ruined, for I'm a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips, and my eyes have seen the King, the Lord Almighty. That is the problem that holiness presents when it comes to us. But luckily, something happens in this passage. I actually didn't give you the next ones, but can you keep going there? Let's go like 7 to 10. Then one of the seraphs flew to me with a live coal in his hand, which he'd taken with tongs from the altar. Go to the next one. Have I not given you it? Must I get it? All right, cool. And with it, he touched my mouth, and he said, see, this has touched your lips. Your guilt is taken away, and your sin is atoned for. You see that something different happened here. Something clean touched something unclean. And something different happened. And that thing is that purity suddenly flows the wrong way. It flows differently to how it's flowed. It flows differently to how sin and corruption has flowed. The purity comes and it touches, and the purity is transferred to what was impure. And this is where we start to see this great plan for mankind emerge. There's this beautiful picture in Ezekiel, and just some background here. It's another vision that Ezekiel has. And, you know, we often sing and talk about the river of life, and it's this great and beautiful picture. And this is actually where this river of life comes from. And Ezekiel has this vision of a river that's flowing out of the temple, and it flows past the altar, and it flows out the doors. And as it flows, it gathers in depth and in strength. And then in Ezekiel 47, verse 7 to 12, it says, and when I arrived there, I saw a great number of trees each side of the river. And he said to me, this water flows towards the eastern region and goes down into the Arabah where it enters the sea. When it empties into the sea, the water there becomes fresh. Swarms of living creatures will live wherever the river flows. There will be large numbers of fish because this water flows there and makes the salt water fresh. So where the river flows, everything will live. Fishermen will stand along the shore from En Gedi to En Glen, and there will be places for spreading nets. The fish will be of many kinds, like the fish of the great sea. But the swarms in the marshes will not become fresh. Fruit trees of all kinds will grow on both banks. Their leaves will not wither, nor will their fruit fail. Every month they will bear, because the water from the sanctuary flows to them. Their fruit will serve for food, and their leaves for healing. That is the story of the gospel, that this river flows from the very presence of God, from the throne room. It flows out. And so instead of us having to get holy and be holy to go into the place where the holy God is, God says, no, I'm going to do something else. I'm going to come to you. I'm going to bring my holiness from where it is inaccessible to you, and I'm going to bring it, and I'm going to make it accessible. I'm coming to you. And what I bring And when I touch you, is going to transform you. And this we see beautifully in the picture of Jesus, man. The perfect sacrifice to end all sacrifices. We sang about him today, this God, Emmanuel, God with us. This perfect, perfect God living in perfect community, fully fulfilled in everything with his Father. And he comes down and leaves behind the deity. He comes and becomes fully man, fully suffers, fully tempted in every way, fully faces every hardship we face, fully. And lives this perfect life in spite of it all. And then dies, lives this life we couldn't live, and dies this death that we should have died. And man, it says that he drank the cup of wrath, the cup meant for Adam, the cup of all the stuff that I have done, all of my sin, all of my brokenness, every mistake, every infraction, every contravention of his law. Every time I've rejected him, he takes it and he drinks this thing to the very, very dregs. And not because I've done anything, not because I deserve it, but because this was the plan. God was like, I need Adam back. And he can't get to me, and so I'm going to him. And he's prophesied about so much in the Old Testament. Isaiah prophesies that he would be born of a virgin, Emmanuel, God with us. Prophesies that he'd be wounded for our transgressions, bruised for our iniquities, that he'd bind up the brokenhearted, that he'd proclaim liberty to the captives, that he'd open prisons. He takes our sin and he gives us his righteousness. He takes our brokenness and our stench and our dead seals and gives us his holiness. Purity flows the other way. There's this passage that I want to show you, this picture in the New Testament of what this looks like. In Luke 8, verse 43 to 48. And I have many favorite stories in the Bible, but this, I think, is just my favorite. And it's, you know, Jesus is walking through this crowd. He's pressed in on all sides. There's this throng that's kind of gathered around him. And it says, as Jesus was on his way, the crowds almost crushed him. And a woman was there who'd been subject to bleeding for 12 years, but no one could heal her. She came up behind him and touched the edge of his cloak, and immediately her bleeding stopped. Who touched me? Jesus asked. When they all denied it, Peter said, Master, the people are crowding and pressing against you. But Jesus said, someone touched me. I know that power has gone out from me. Then the woman, seeing that she could not go unnoticed, came trembling and fell at his feet. And in the presence of all the people, she told him why she had touched him and how she had been instantly healed. And Jesus says to her, daughter, daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace. What she did when she touched Jesus should have made Jesus ceremonially unclean. What happened when she touched Jesus is that it flowed the other way. You know, she was ceremonially and socially unclean. But that's the truth of you and I in our lives, is that, you know, it doesn't say she'd done anything wrong there. That wasn't necessarily sin. For you and I, we've got the sin problem, man. That thing is in us. And I often wonder about her. She, you know, everyone knew she'd been suffering for 12 years. Everybody knew that she was unclean. She had no right, actually, to be in that place. She had no right touching Jesus. She had no right actually being in that crowd, because anyone who she touched would have been unclean. They wouldn't have been able to go actually and worship and go to the temple. I love it that her faith was so imperfect. Almost seems a bit superstitious. It's like, man, if I can just touch his clothes, maybe something will happen. And I love it that even in her imperfect faith, something about the nature and character of Jesus reaches out and touches her. I love it that she knew there was something about him. It's like, man, if I can just get close enough, if I can just get close enough to touch him, something will change. And that's the beauty of faith. I think For us, often the object of our faith is probably far more important than how perfect or quality or how good we are in our understanding of our faith. Because we don't actually have faith in faith. I don't have faith in faith. I don't know a large part of the time what I'm doing. I really don't. But I know someone. I know Jesus. My faith is in the person of Jesus. And that when it's all going crazy and I don't know what to do, if I just can touch him, something will change. I love it that this is immediate. It's like she touches him and immediately there's this beautiful, beautiful transfer. Do you realize that this is the thing you carry? Do you know that this is the good news? This is the thing you know that the world doesn't know. Is that, man, I know someone. And if you touch him, something's going to change. You're dying and you're sick and nothing has worked and you've tried every other physician and you've tried every other healer and you've tried every other life coach and you've tried every other fitness and every other supplement and every other job change and every other, and nothing of it has worked for you. If you would just touch him. This is the good news of the gospel. And in this story, we see she had tried everything else, and everything else had just left her poorer and worse off. She spent all she had and was no better. And this is the gospel, man. No matter how long you've been stuck, no matter how deeply broken you are, no matter how wild and creative the avenues you've gone down to try and find healing, no matter how unhealable or irredeemable or broken or long that stuckness is in you, when you come to him, purity is going to flow the other way. And this thing is about so much more than just being near him. So much more than just doing the things of the faith. We see her. There's this crowd pressed around Jesus. They can't avoid jostling him and touching him. But the one who's changed isn't the one who's near. It's the one who reaches out with faith. Spurgeon wrote, "It's not every contact with Christ that saves men. It's the arousing of yourself to come near to him, the determinate, the personal, resolute, believing touch of Jesus Christ, which saves." This gospel we're speaking about, it's not about growing a church. It's not about growing a crowd. It's not about becoming part of the throng. It's not about proximity. Even Israel, they had the ark, and then they had the temple. They had the very presence of God amongst them. And that still wasn't enough because it was about a relationship. It was about this personal connection. And even in this story, it's so beautiful that Jesus heals this woman. And then when he speaks to her, he doesn't call her disciple or follower or new convert or member. Daughter. This contact with Jesus transforms her into a child of his, into this daughter, into this beautiful, intimate, close person. And it's the most profound thing for me. And then he doesn't just heal her, but he sends her on her way with peace, acceptance, belonging, not shame. Even when he calls her out, he doesn't call her out to say, "Hey, who touched me? And how dare you? And who said you could?" And it's like, no, he calls her out because he's like, "Man, I want to call you something. I want to speak to you. I want to minister to you far more than just your healing. I want to call you daughter, and I want to send you with peace." It is the story of the gospel. It is the story of the thing we carry. So Jesus wants to come and touch. And let this thing flow the other way. And not just at the moment of salvation, man. I thank the Lord that my story did not stop when I came and met him. That picture of that river flowing, the further you walk with that river of life, the deeper it gets, the wider it gets, the more of it there is, the more of you it covers, the further it takes you, the more wild and unstuck it gets. Eventually, in that vision, he's kind of swimming and out of touch, and it all feels a little bit crazy. But that's the story of salvation, is that this thing would come and take over all of us and consume us and fill us. Even 4:12, this conference that we're having, you know, it's like, yes, it's the equipping of the saints for the work of the ministry, but so that the whole body may be built up and matured, attaining full unity and being transformed into the full image of Christ. We're made to be in his image, and it's the gospel that transforms us. And is the gospel still the gospel to you? Is it still the good news to you? That's the thing I often find challenging myself. I'm like, man, is this thing still exciting to me? Is it still the thing I carry? And not just for others, but for me. When I step on dead seals and when I mess up and when I've blown it again, and am I coming back to this place of the gospel? Like, Jesus, I know I smell funny, but man, I need you. I need you. Would you come? I don't ever just want to be part of the crowd who's around Jesus and around the things he's doing and around church and at the meetings and on the teams and serving in this and never stretching out my hand in faith to encounter and to meet Jesus. Are you still looking for him in the battles of your life when your marriage is tough and work is difficult and there's that relationship that sucks and this sickness in my body? And are you stretching out your hand in faith and being like, Jesus, I need to touch you, because when I do, something is going to change? Are you letting him work out that salvation in you still? Are you letting that gospel come in and transform your lives? Or are we desperately trying to manage these things, going to every other doctor, going to every other treatment, trying to medicate this thing? And please, man, I've got no problem. I'm a big fan of doctors. I've used them many times. They're great. Go to them, 100%. But man, are we also praying? Are we also going to the Lord first? Are we praying for others, man? And I tell you, I've seen some wild stories of people just praying for people who they can see are sick and see are suffering and see. And the Lord does something, and he touches them, and something flows, and faith rises, and they're like, man, I want to meet this person you're speaking about. Because if we're just medicating this stuff with coping mechanisms or distractions or toys or hobbies or fitness or fun or whatever the thing is that's going to try and deal with the brokenness, you just land up still bleeding and poor, having spent everything, having lost everything. Are we going to Jesus? Because when he touches her, she's healed. I love it that her shame is even removed. He looks at her and he calls her daughter. There's this closeness. And so to carry and to minister the gospel, we need to understand the problem and the solution, that this thing's not actually about morality. I'm not really interested in you becoming a Christian so that you will be better and do your taxes honestly and follow the speed limit and not steal. Those things are all good. You can do all those things and still not be close to Jesus. It's not about morality. It's about intimacy. We cannot treat sin symptomatically. It's not a symptomatic gospel. It's a transformative one. It comes in and it changes us. We're made for him. We're made by him. We're made to coexist with him. And so when our brokenness and sin and the things of this world touch us and things suck, we need to go back to him so that he can actually transform us, so that we can then coexist with him, so that the darkness in us is dealt with, so that there's his light and then his light in us, and those two things can be together and we can be close to him. I love it. Michael also shared it earlier. It's great. Like this gospel, it's not even about turning away from something. It's about what we turn to. It's like, yes, man, we turn from all of that stuff to Jesus. But I hate my sin because of what it does to my relationship with him. I hate my sin because what it does to the relationship of those people that I'm close with who also love him. I hate what it does to my marriage and to my children and to my coworkers and to my times with Jesus and to the intimacy. We need this purity to start to flow the other way in us. So my problem, my question is, are you carrying this gospel in you? Are you carrying excitement for it? Is it coming to you, first of all? Are you living this thing and allowing it to change you and taking the messed up, broken, deficient parts to Him? But also, are we carrying it out into the world? When we see people in need, when we see the brokenness, when we see the lonely, are we organizing pokey competitions? Because, man, someone's going to come and they're going to meet Jesus. I love that story. That gives me so much faith because that is the gospel, man. That is the whole point of it. We're praying for people. Those we know going through really, really difficult and tough things, are we praying for them? And then when they really, really hit rock bottom, when there is nothing left and they have nowhere else to turn, I love desperation, actually. Desperation can be a beautiful thing in someone. Because when you have tried everything else, can I take you to the one I know? I wonder how different that lady's life would have been if someone had found her sooner. Said, hey, there's this guy in town. His name's Jesus. I don't fully understand it, but stuff happens when he's around and stuff happens when people touch him. Can I take you? Can I come and show you this one I know? Can I come and introduce you to him? I don't have all the answers, but man, he is the answer. Are we seeing people not as they are, but as they could be in the hands of grace if they met him? And I'm guilty of this. I have sometimes seen some people and I've been like, yo, that guy. If I speak to him, if I reach out to him, he is going to become my problem. And he is very broken. And he is going to be very, very hard work. And he is going to cost me a lot of time and energy and resource and prayer and anxiety. And do I really want to do this? But we can't look at people with their present condition. There's this almost looking to them with the future potential they have as the transformative power of the gospel takes hold of them. 2 Corinthians 5:16 says, from now on, we regard no one from a worldly point of view. Though we once regarded Christ in this way, we do so no longer. Therefore, if anyone was in Christ, the new creation has come. I was that guy who walked through these doors and everyone was like, "Ish, here comes hard work," and hard work's name is Adam. And I thank the Lord that those guys took the time to love me and to invest in me and to introduce me to this Jesus, because my life is transformed by the gospel when it came to me. But then as I walked it out with these guys and they helped me and loved me and built into me. Are we looking at the most broken, the most difficult, the most lost, the outcasts, those who've been bleeding for 12 years and saying, maybe they don't have to bleed anymore. Maybe they could come and meet the one. Because it's those that Jesus looks at and he calls them daughter. He calls them son. And that's how Jesus found me, man. There was nothing about me that was redeeming. There was nothing that was worth it. He got nothing out of it. I was so broken, so lost, so confused, so messed up, so angry, so rebellious, so hurtful to others. And then this Jesus looks at me and says, Adam, I'm going to touch you, man. And something's going to happen. And something did happen. Now, could we get someone up on worship quick?